Chapter 17. It's not just me. The last 20 minutes in the airport were the hardest for Paul Radu. "She's going to be surprised when she sees you," his colleague Miranda Petruchik suggested. "After so long." "So long," Paul said, almost wistfully. "So long." "Yes. She must be so relieved that she's here now. I can't even imagine what the feeling is, to travel after so much time and to be out." Paul and Miranda were still pacing the polished concourse floor 20 minutes later, not entirely certain their friend had made the flight from Baku to Ankara. The Azerbaijani security services could have detained her at the airport terminal in Baku, or even pulled her off the plane at the last minute. But the two were hopeful. "Do you think she will recognize us with these masks?" Miranda asked. "I was asking myself the same thing," Paul said, as he started to nudge forward toward the gates. "People are coming. People are coming. Any moment now, any moment now." "It's like a delivery room," Miranda said, watching other travelers from flight 2162 file out of the gates with their luggage in hand. Paul cast his mind back to when he last saw Khadija Ismailova, who had not been permitted to leave her hometown of Baku since 2014. She had spent those years in pretrial detention, then in prison, then living under a government-imposed travel ban. The authorities in Azerbaijan had shown little leniency in that time. When Khadija's mother traveled from Baku to Ankara for cancer treatments, Khadija's request to accompany her was denied. Neither was she allowed to leave the country to be at her mother's deathbed in Ankara some months later. "Do you know how much time it's been?" Paul said, watching as travelers continued to file out of the arrival gates and into the main concourse. "Almost 8 years." Paul and Miranda finally caught a glimpse of Khadija in a colorful pink shirt through the glass doors leading from the gates. She was one of the last passengers to make it into the main terminal, but she was out. Finally. Paul and Miranda ran to their surprised friend and wrapped her in hugs. The three were laughing and crying all at once. Khadija Ismailova was, temporarily and uncharacteristically, unable to speak. "Wow, hey," was all Paul could say. "Wow, wow." "Finally," Khadija was able to say. "It's been so many years." "We were counting 7+ years, Paul answered. No, it's been less than 7, answered Khadija, who had suddenly regained her composure. She was a journalist first and foremost, by training and by instinct. Above all else, even at the most emotional of times, accuracy mattered to Khadija. "It will be 7 in October." Khadija thought of Ankara as a temporary way station. Her plan was to get back to her work in Azerbaijan as soon as possible. So she arrived as any guest would, as her mother had taught her, with food in hand. She had spent the day before preparing grape leaves stuffed with beef, and her dolma was among salads and baked fish and wine at the table that night. When Paul and Miranda and Khadija and our fellow journalist Drew Sullivan and Khadija's sister and a few other friends had a celebratory dinner that lasted into the small hours of the night. It was like old times, Khadija pouring wine and dishing food and describing the method of cooking a proper pilaf. "The walls of the pan should be as hot as the bottom," she would say. If she was in the mood, and it didn't take much wine, Khadija would turn her beautiful singing voice to the March of Azerbaijan, the national anthem, restored in 1992 after the 70-year enforced hiatus during Soviet dominance in her home country. Paul had been anticipating the celebration for days, remembering various happy nights with Khadija when he had still been allowed to visit Baku. A founder of the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, Paul had been working with Khadija for 15 years, first as a mentor, then as a colleague. We would go to this bar that was a bit outside, Paul told Miranda as they were driving back from the airport in Ankara. We partied there, and then we would go to her home to party some more. There would be this huge table with everything on it, all sorts of foods. And it kept on coming. Drinks, food, everything. We had some good parties. That's the part which, for me, is so great about Khadija. Miranda agreed. Miranda had been at OCCRP since 2006 and led its coverage of the Caucasus. She was one of the journalists who picked up Khadija's reporting and made sure her stories kept getting told even when Khadija was blocked by the Azeri government. She's always partying. I mean, this is kind of in her blood. She has a very strong spirit of friendship. She's working hard, but she's also partying, Paul remembered. And to be honest, I never saw her angry, Khadija. I saw her a little bit upset, you know, discussing something serious, but never angry. Everybody agreed the next day, when the visit turned to business, that the grand arrival dinner had been a rousing success. Khadija, however, started the meeting by apologizing. My sister told me last night that I didn't let anyone eat. I was speaking nonstop, and people were so polite. We ate, Paul insisted, and it was a lot of really good stories. Well, someone should stop me when I talk so much. The small group did not spend much time joking around, because at long last, with Khadija safely out of Azerbaijan, Paul and Miranda and their fellow editor at OCCRP, Drew Sullivan, were able to fill in their longtime colleague about the Pegasus Project. So I can tell you and solve the mystery, Miranda said to Khadija. You know NSO, the Israeli company that is selling surveillance software? Okay, Khadija answered, a bit puzzled. Miranda explained the leak and the list, and that more than 1,000 of the selections were in Azerbaijan. Khadija was among the selections, Miranda told her, and there was a good chance her phone had been compromised by Pegasus spyware. Her attorney was also in the data. It all happens in the background, and you have no idea that you are infected, Miranda told her. And when you're infected, it's transmitting your messages, your images, everything that's happened on your phone. So it's very, very dangerous because you don't know, and it allows the government or whoever is the client to basically get everything from the person's phone. And it's legal to sell it? Khadija asked. Yes. Khadija agreed right away to let Miranda do the backup of her two iPhones and upload them for Claudio and Danica to analyze for evidence of infection. She was pleased to hear that they would have results the next day. Khadija professed shock at the number of Azeris who had been selected for possible Pegasus infection. A waste of public money, she said. But her own presence on the list was no great surprise. She would have been more surprised if she were not on that list. The fundamental difficulty in Khadija Ismailova's life, and what landed her on that list, is that she and Azeri President Ilham Aliyev agree on very little, and least of all do they agree on the matter of Khadija Ismailova. In President Aliyev's view, Khadija has been, as he told the U.S. State Department as early as 2009, an enemy of the government and a threat to stability in Azerbaijan. Khadija sees things differently. Khadija Ismailova can tell you exactly when it first began to dawn on her that the official government view did not necessarily accord with the truce, and thus with her own view. She was 10 years old, at home in Baku, then the capital city of a Soviet Socialist Republic, observing her parents in a moment of heated passion. They were watching a live televised soccer match between the Soviet Union and Turkey. Khadija's parents were educated and successful professionals, both engineers. Her mother had left her job to stay home with the children, while her father had risen to a high-level post at the Ministry of Energy in Baku. If her father was taking a cut of the spoils available to any opportunistic official, in the most vital and lucrative Soviet ministry in Azerbaijan. It was hard to see. The family did have a comfortable beach cottage, so she and her siblings spent the summer swimming in the Caspian Sea. But like almost every Azeri family in the mid-1980s, the Ismailovs depended on small government stipends to guarantee the household supply of butter, meat, milk, sugar, and other staples. Khadija, along with the available contingent of brothers and sisters, was often forcibly marched by her mother to assist with the grocery shopping. Her mom probably wanted the company because she might be facing a 4-hour wait in line. Khadija figures she spent about half her waking childhood in line at a market. Up to the age of 10, Khadija viewed such difficult outings as acts of thoroughgoing patriotism. This was sacrifice for a greater cause, the kind of sacrifice Westerners were too weak to make, the kind of sacrifice that would ensure the eventual Soviet triumph in the Cold War. Khadija enjoyed writing poems about the glory of her empire, the Soviet Union. She was a very dedicated young patriot. Then, there she was, watching this soccer match with her parents in the privacy of their own home, the USSR versus Turkey. And her mother and father were both cheering for Turkey. Young Khadija was taken aback. Azerbaijanis were supposed to be proud members of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. Why were her parents pulling for Turkey? She asked her mom, who stopped cheering long enough to explain. Turkey was actually their brother country, she said, and the Ismailovs, like most Azeri families, were of Turkish stock. But wait a minute, Khadija wondered. Isn't Russia our brother country? That's what they taught her in school. Khadija's mom kept talking. The Russians had first occupied Azerbaijan, she said, and now we are kind of occupied by the Soviet Union. Khadija's father jumped in with a note of caution, which turned out to be equally jolting. Don't tell her those things, he warned. She will go and say something in school, and then we will be harassed. That's going to be a problem. Khadija had very suddenly, and very unexpectedly, got hold of some serious unofficial truths. She still laughs whenever she describes the moment the scales fell from her 10-year-old eyes. I've learned that the Soviet Empire was actually a Russian empire, and that we were occupied, she would say. I've learned about our Turkic origin. I've learned about censorship and oppression in our country. All in 10 minutes. Before that time, I was writing poems about the Cold War and Lenin. Before that time, I've been very active in school events, very active in speaking about the Soviet Union and what a good country we have. So that was the day when I stopped writing poems. I stopped going to communist events at school. I think that was the day I turned into a rebel. Khadija was a happy warrior in the Azeri National Liberation Movement in her teens. And by the time the country voted for independence from the Russians and their collapsing empire, she already knew all the words to the March of Azerbaijan. She started her career in journalism the year after Azeri independence and enjoyed the freedom to write just about anything she wanted. At least as long as she stuck to soft topics like pop culture and human interest stories, and steered clear of topics like politics and governance. The Republic of Azerbaijan had lurched pretty quickly from a hopeful democracy to a petrostate controlled by a handful of old Soviet apparatchiks, led by the former head of the KGB in Azerbaijan, Heydar Aliyev. Before he died in 2003, President Heydar Aliyev ensured transfer of power to his 41-year-old son, Ilham, who had been educated at university in Moscow and served as vice president of the state-owned oil entity, making deals with the major Western oil companies until his political coronation. The second-generation Aliyev regime quickly scared off any serious political opposition, bought up most of the media in the country, and sidelined pretty much any journalist who did things a journalist was supposed to do, like figure out how public funds were being spent. the only reporter still trying to do that sort of investigation in 2005. Elmar Huseynov was assassinated that year, shot 6 times at point-blank range in the stairwell of his apartment building. The lesson Team Aliyev appeared to be offering anybody working in the field of journalism was quite clear. But then, it had been a long time since Khadija accepted official lessons at face value. This turned out to be the second crucial pivot point in her life. Huseynov was the only one speaking out about the first family corruption, Khadija remembers. He was the only one uncovering the first family's corrupt businesses. And he paid the ultimate price. He lost his life. The night we heard about the assassination, the first thing that came into my mind was, we, other Azeri journalists, are also guilty for that. We are part of the problem because he was the only one, and they thought it's easy to achieve silence by killing one. If there were more of us, they wouldn't count on complete silence by killing one journalist. So we were responsible for his death as well. Khadija determined to pick up where Elmar Huseynov had left off, though she didn't know the first thing about investigating fraud and corruption in government, or how to follow the money flowing through the state-owned oil company, or how to locate the offshore shell companies used to obscure that money trail. She turned for training and advice to the OCCRP, which was co-founded the same year by Paul Radu and Drew Sullivan. Paul put her onto an early data leak of financial documents out of Panama, identifying the owners of shell companies operating in known tax havens around the world. Some of the documents pointed to Aliyev and his family, and Khadija meticulously connected the dots and then bravely published her findings in Azerbaijan. This was a huge breakthrough, says Paul Radu. Up to this point, the Aliyev family was operating in the dark. Khadija was the one who pulled the curtain. She pulled it wide so the world could see the corruption of the regime. Khadija's reports on the apparently precocious and prodigious offspring of Ilham Aliyev were particularly revealing. Working as bureau chief of Radio Free Europe / Radio Liberty, RFE/RL, she unearthed a trail of documents that showed a remarkable portfolio of assets for the children of a man who earned a $230,000 a year government salary. Aliyev's 2 daughters managed to accrue between them and before they hit age 25, major stakes in airlines, banks, a mobile phone company, and a gold and silver mining operation. They also owned another $30 million in real estate around the world. Their younger brother, at the age of 11, had acquired property in Dubai worth $44 million. President Aliyev's in-laws, meanwhile, controlled major operations in banking, insurance, travel, cosmetics, car dealerships, and construction, all under the umbrella of Pasha Holdings. The first lady's family, the Pashaevs, had built a shopping center, a residential tower, the Four Seasons Hotel, the JW Marriott Hotel, and the Amburan Marriott Beach Resort with speed and efficiency that defied long-standing local timelines. Smaller builders were always slowed by tax authorities, fire marshals, and building inspectors who expected to be paid off. Not surprisingly, noted one foreign diplomat in Baku, projects by Pasha Construction face few, if any, of these setbacks, and are generally among the fastest to be built in Azerbaijan. Khadija's initial reporting marked her as a figure who required close scrutiny by the people who protect presidential prerogatives in Azerbaijan. The Aliyevs want to be considered as if they are a respectable member of the family of European democracies, says Gerald Knaus, the founding director of the European Stability Initiative. So they care much more about their image than European dictatorships used to. Foreign officials in Azerbaijan and investigative reporters from outside the country began to follow Khadija and do their own digging into Aliyev family finances and its penchant for obscuring and offshoring their wealth. One U.S. State Department official filed a report comparing the Aliyevs to the fictional Corleone crime family from The Godfather. The president seemed to vacillate between the cool and rational Michael and the hot-headed and not particularly bright Sonny, according to the report. Aliyev's wife came in for some particularly catty and undiplomatic chatter about her personal vanity. First Lady Mehriban Aliyeva appears to have had substantial cosmetic surgery, presumably overseas, and wears dresses that would be considered provocative even in the Western world, read one 2010 cable from a U.S. diplomat in Azerbaijan. On television, in photos, and in person, she appears unable to show a range of facial expressions. Khadija didn't much concern herself with how the Aliyevs spent their fortune, but in how they amassed it. Her work for RFE/RL focused on the intersection in Azerbaijan where politics, governance, and corruption converge. She wanted to know how President Aliyev rigged his re-election in 2008, how he convinced the Azeri parliament to do away with term limits. He could be president for life. And how he pushed through new laws to keep information about national finances from public view. Khadija managed to break the story that the $38.5 million construction contract to build National Flag Square, with the highest flagpole in the world at a towering 162 meters, 6 feet taller than North Korea's, had been awarded to a company owned by the president's daughters. The flagpole thing didn't work out so well. Tajikistan built its own new flagpole, which ran to 165 meters high, just 2 months later. The RFE/RL report that Azerbaijan had lost its world record in such a short time was regarded inside the Azeri government as an attempt to humiliate the nation and thus its president. A confidential informant who advised both Ilham and Ilham's father, Haydar, noted the younger man's exceedingly thin skin and his rising ire at independent journalists in the country in the wake of the flagpole revelations. Haydar would never have allowed himself to be goaded into the ridiculous reactions, the informant said, according to one diplomatic cable. Ilham is not inclined to subtlety or deliberation in his response to these kinds of issues. I don't feel I have to wipe everybody out, Ilham had said. Just my enemies. Aliyev's obsession with honor means those who criticize and expose corruption will be seen as enemies of the state, Knaus says. The rulers know that in the end, their rule is more fragile than it might appear. If you are insecure, you cannot tolerate any dissent. You crush everything. The crackdown was swift and energetic. Critics of the Azeri government were harassed, arrested, and imprisoned. A blogger who impersonated Ilham Aliyev in a donkey costume on YouTube ended up in prison for 2.5 years. The sentence might appear harsh, Aliyev explained to one EU president, but it was needed to protect our statehood. The first big blow aimed at Khadija came in early 2012, while she was investigating the Aliyev family's most recent and towering bit of corruption, siphoning money from the $134 million contract to construct a 23,000-seat arena for that year's Eurovision Song Contest. Khadija still remembers the date the unmarked package arrived at her house, March 7, 2012. Inside the envelope were grainy screenshots taken from a videotape. They showed Khadija and her boyfriend engaged in sex. "Whore," read the accompanying note. "Behave, or you will be defamed." Khadija's friends warned her to tread carefully, but she didn't listen. She went on her radio show and explained that she was being blackmailed, but that her tormentors were not going to intimidate her. She was going to keep reporting. A week later, when the entire video surfaced on an Azeri Facebook page, Khadija was not so sure. She and her boyfriend noted the various angles in the videotape and used them to seek out all the hidden cameras in the apartment. The cameras had been removed, but the cables were still in the walls and led to the bedroom, the living room, and the toilet. Then you try to remember what you have been doing in front of the hidden cameras, and it paralyzes your life, Khadija told us. I mean, your body stops functioning. I went through this for 8 or 9 days. I couldn't use a toilet. I mean, not even in public places. My body was swelling. The surveillance had a real impact on my health for almost a year. I couldn't restart any relationship with anyone because I was afraid. I still don't know whether my boyfriend was involved in the scheme or not. You don't trust anyone. But Khadija decided she would not stand down. She published her investigation into corruption in the Crystal Hall Arena less than 2 months after the sex video was posted on Facebook. The First family is personally profiting from the massive construction project through its hidden ownership in the Azenko Construction Company, Khadija reported. Along with the fact that Azenko had been awarded contracts worth $79 million in a single year. The 2012 Eurovision event will have one other tie to the First family, besides the new showcase auditorium. The president's son-in-law, singer Emin Ahalarov, was chosen to entertain the crowds between acts. Emin did a pretty good job after that of keeping his name out of other political stories, until he made the mistake of calling Donald Trump Jr. in 2016, to offer him dirt on the Hillary Clinton campaign, courtesy of the Kremlin. The entire blackmail episode appeared to have backfired on the Aliyev family when Khadija was invited to New York to receive the International Women's Media Foundation's 2012 Courage in Journalism Award. She took the opportunity to call out the Aliyev government and others. Silence is what these regimes need, Khadija said. Silence helps them continue to deprive their people of opportunities. With the consolidation of power and money, crime and government, accompanied with disabled justice systems, independent journalists become the main targets, as they become the only means for resistance for society against corruption and organized crime. That appeared to be the final straw for those protecting the stability of Azerbaijan. Khadija was arrested in Baku a few months later and then suffered through a series of other arrests, convictions on bogus charges, nearly 2 years in prison, and a long travel ban. The trip to Ankara to meet with Paul and Miranda about the Pegasus project in the final days of May 2021 was the first time she had left the Azerbaijan since 2014. Claudio was not really looking forward to his call to Ankara to report his initial findings to Khadija. Sometimes, he would say, he felt like a medieval doctor, powerless to save anyone, just there to make an accurate body count. Claudio had been delivering so much bad news to so many victims lately that it was starting to weigh on him. The worst part, for Claudio, is that he really couldn't offer the instant protection these traumatized people so clearly craved. He could give them advice, but not a failsafe to dodge the spyware. I'm the one that has to tell them. You know, there's nothing I can do for you. He admitted to us long after the Pegasus project was completed. I can't meaningfully provide you anything to prevent you from being in the same position and getting infected again in a month or even tomorrow. But Claudio picked up the phone and made the call to Ankara as scheduled on May 31st, 2021. And Khadija didn't waste any time. So, now tell me how bad it is, she told him. Claudio ran through the basics while Khadija processed the information. The phone showed evidence of multiple cases of attempted or actual infection starting back in 2018. The attacks continued well beyond the time frame where our leaked data ended, the most recent just a few weeks earlier. Paul, Miranda, and Khadija all had questions about the mechanics of the infections, and Claudio patiently answered them all. Then Drew jumped in with what felt like an attempt to soften the blow. At least Khadija's messages on highly encrypted apps like Signal were still private, Drew suggested. Right? Sorry, Claudio said. Nothing on that phone was beyond the reach of Pegasus. When you have this sort of spyware running on the device, he explained, there's not really a whole lot of encryption that holds up. Claudio had promised to spend as much time as they needed on the phone, and he stayed on the line until everybody in Ankara ran out of questions. When he hung up, Khadija stood and walked away from the group. Well, that's not great news, Drew said to the rest of the group. Even back in Berlin, off the line, Claudio knew exactly what Khadija was experiencing. He had seen it so many times already. First, they are kind of in denial, and then they start to understand, and it becomes a miserable experience, because you see them going through a massive sense of guilt. You can see them start thinking not about themselves, but what I've cost others. Who else did they compromise? Who else might have been put at risk because of them? They always take it very personally, like, I did something wrong. Claudia was correct, of course. Also in the data, Khadija now knew, were her niece, her sister, even her favorite taxi driver. The thing Khadija could not shake was her communications regarding one particular friend who had been fighting breast cancer. Khadija had been taking care of her after her surgery. Among the tasks was taking pictures of the surgical wound when she changed her dressings every day, and then sending the photographs to her doctor. Some government thug, Khadija feared, may have used Pegasus to intercept those very private photographs. She had been tossing and turning in bed all night thinking about that, even before Claudio had confirmed the presence of spyware on her iPhone for the past 3 years. I feel guilty, she confessed to her friends from OCCRP in the hours after the call with Claudio. I feel guilty for the messages I've sent. I feel guilty for the sources who send me messages thinking that some encrypted messaging ways are secure. And they didn't know that my phone is infected. My family members are also victimized. My sources are victimized. People I've been working with, people who told me their private secrets, are victimized. I put so many people in danger, and I'm angry with the government. I'm angry with the companies who produce all of these tools and sell it to the bad guys like the Aliyev regime. It's despicable. It's heinous. It's not just me. Like, when the video was exposed, it was just me. Now I don't know who else has been exposed because of me, and who else is in danger because of me.